22nd, 2016. Let the record reflect the time is 3:33 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Coghill, Senator Michiki, Senator Stedman, and Senator Stoltz, as well as myself, Senator Giesel. Senator Coghill, or excuse me, Senator Costello is excused today. Thank you to Anne and to Christy who are helping us out recording the meeting and working our audio. So today the committee will first take up the appointment, the confirmation of, it's actually the appointment, we're not confirming him today, of Nathan Turner to the Board of Game. So Mr. Turner has joined us online. Mr. Turner, can you hear us?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us. You are a reappointment to the Board of Game. All the committee members have your resume, so that's great. If you would just briefly review for us why you'd like to continue on the Board of Game.
Yes, I'd be happy to. And first, I have to apologize. I'm getting over a little bit of a cold, so it's hard for me to hear and a little bit hard for me to speak.
Mr. Turner, if you would
continue with the Board of Game, if it's the desire of the legislature, primarily for a couple of reasons. I've been on the board now for 6 years, and I think as a natural order of course of things, you get invested in the processes that you've devoted a lot of time and thought and effort to. I guess to state it directly, I've really enjoyed being on the board. I've been able to see some of the changes that we've made, some minor adjustments here and there to hunting seasons throughout the state, and I've enjoyed the process, and I've also enjoyed working with the people of Alaska in different parts of the state. And those are the primary reasons. I actually enjoy the work, and I feel that I'm giving something back to the state for the many years that the state's blessed me and my family.
Very good. Mr. Turner, if you could formally introduce yourself for the record, just your name, affiliation, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, sorry. For the record, my name is Nathan Turner, and I live in the Kantishna River and the Nowitna River drainages for most of each year. And other times of the year, I'm in the Rooks Range or in the Alaska Peninsula, and I do spend sometimes between 6 and 8 weeks each year in Fairbanks.
Very good. Thank you. Committee members, questions for Mr. Turner? Well, Mr. Turner, I have read your bio, but for the public who's listening, could you outline your engagement in the utilization of our game resources? In other words, what do you do for a living?
Well, sure. My family and I came to Alaska, I believe, 26 years ago, following my father's dream to be a trapper in the North Country. And I was pretty young at the time. I was 17, and it wasn't my ambition to be a trapper or a hunting guide even. I thought I would be a journalist and travel the world. But when I came to the country with my father, I fell in love with it, and I realized that his dream, what he'd been telling me ever since being a child, was really true. That there's something special about living close to the land and depending on the land and being connected to it, and I think for the first 10 years, I never saw a street in Alaska with snow on it. I spent only my time out in the woods on the trap line. And then over the years, a neighboring trapper who worked as a hunting guide offered to employ me as a packer on a hunt 1 year. And then later, he helped me become an assistant guide. And then later, I became a registered guide on my own. And so between trapping and guiding, that's been my primary source of income for all of my adult life. And my family, my father, for example, and his wife, Fran, who live on the trap line year-round, that's their only source of income is from trapping. And I guess you could say subsistence gardening. We grow almost everything we eat and dry it and put it away for the winter. I'm not sure if it's accurate or not, but how long it's been since another board of game member has, I guess, had part of the resume, the statement that we live entirely from the land, and that is our sole source of sustenance, even if it's guiding. I still continue. I consider that as a type, an extension of my subsistence lifestyle, because we do rely on it for our both financial returns, but also our immediate returns from the meat that we share with the people in the country.
Very good. Thanks for sharing all that. Any other questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Coghill.
First of all, Nate, thanks for willing to serve. I did get a question sent in to me by a constituent of mine, and probably should ask it on the record, and that was with regard to AC proposal on test bear trapping season. And he said that you had gone against the advisory committee's recommendations. Can you give some answer to that?
I'd be happy to. Could you repeat again what the topic was about?
It was the proposal from one of the ACs on the a bear trapping season that was supposed to be a test.
You know, we had a period for several years that we had a lot of discussions about bear trapping. I initially was, there's several different concepts, I guess, related to that. There was a test area by the initiated by the board and conducted by the department and members of the public in the Cook Inlet region for a number of years regarding whether controlling bear predation would help moose populations. That happened before I was on the board, but I did vote to continue that test because that's how I viewed it, as exactly an opportunity as a learning process. We did discuss in other parts of the state whether to try to create an opportunity for bear trapping for private individuals in remote areas of the state. I supported that idea, but it didn't pass the muster from the rest of the board, so it really went nowhere in the end. I don't remember voting against bear trapping specifically, but it's a topic that I've always felt that if handled correctly and well thought out, it's something that could be helpful in rural communities to allow people to help themselves. But it is something that you couldn't just have happening any place under a normal trapping season.
And follow-up, Senator?
I don't know, unless I have the specifics about the actual topic that they were referring to, I couldn't give a more clear answer, I think.
Maybe one of the ways to clarify it would be it was a Fairbanks Advisory Committee, and I think they were talking about a Fairbanks area proposal.
I'm sorry, I don't remember it.
I thought I'd ask.
They
were not happy with it, and they wanted me to ask you, so I don't have any bone to pick. I just thought I'd ask.
Yeah. As you may be aware, Senator Coghill, bear trapping in itself was a very controversial topic for the Board of Game to even bring up in the state. And we even had a former governor sit in front of us and ask us to not go down that path, and a number of different individuals. And it was a topic that brought out a lot of emotions on both sides of the issue.
Thanks for weathering it.
I survived so far.
Further questions from committee members? All right, seeing none, we will go to public comment, and perhaps committee members will have questions after that. I see first up here Mr. Bob Mumford in Anchorage. Mr. Mumford, can you hear us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Welcome. If you would give your name and affiliation and give us your testimony about this appointee.
Well, thank you, Chairman Riesel and committee members. I'm Bob Mumford, unaffiliated in this testimony. I wanted to call in support of Mr. Turner's reappointment to the Board of Game. I was on the Board of Game with Mr. Turner for 3 years, and it was my pleasure to work with him on that. Nate is a good, solid, he's a strong board member. He comes to the meetings prepared. He takes it very, very seriously. And in the years I've worked with him, I never saw that he was there to push any single issue or agenda that, you know, a lot of times you'll find people do that on these boards. And, you know, some of you know me, I've been on some of these boards and I've seen that. Nate's fair and balanced. He really is. And he's a very good, productive member. He and I have disagreed on a number of issues at times. And even in doing that, I think we've had a mutual respect with one another. He's able to articulate his opinions well to me, and even though I disagreed with him at times, I was generally able to see where he was coming from, and you know, I could see some logic behind what he was thinking. It was never one of those things that was way off of the tracks, I don't think. But, you know, I would disagree with it. And, but like I said, it was always done with mutual respect. And one of the strengths that I see in Nate on these boards is he's able to stand up at times. These board members, these board meetings are often attended by certain user groups that are there to push an agenda, and they push it extremely hard, either conservation groups or some, you know, activist hunting groups even that think that everything should be easily killed and they should be able to be the ones that easily kill it all. And he's able to stand up and weather the storm from a lot of people that have varying opinions, and that's something that I admire, that he doesn't just cave into the various opinions. He's able to weigh all issues and stand up when it's right, I think. So I admire Nate an awful lot. I think he's, besides being a really good man, he's a really good board member. I think he serves the board real well and should be reappointed.
Great. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Mumford. Yes, a question. Mr. Mumford, hold for a moment. Senator Stoltz has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Mumford, for your service on both the Board of Fish and the Board of Game. Sounds like you're a glutton for punishment, doing both tours. But are you only speaking on behalf of one nominee to the board? You've chosen just to address Mr. Mumford. Mr. Turner, excuse me.
At this time, yes.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Mumford? All right, seeing none. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Mumford. Next here in the room, Mr. Thor Stacey has signed up to testify. Mr. Stacey. While Mr. Stacey is coming forward, we did receive a letter of support also from the Safari Club International Alaska chapter, and I believe committee members have that on their desk. It will go on to basis after the meeting. Mr. Stacey, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Thor Stacey, and I'm here representing the Alaska Professional Hunters Association. I'm going to keep my comments kind of brief in general. The Alaska Professional Hunters Association is the only organized association or group representing Alaska's hunting guide industry in the state. We have approximately 135 members, and then within the state of Alaska, there's plus or minus right around 300 active registered hunting guides at any one time. Alaska's guiding industry is significant. One of the two defined commercial services that's allowed to market or sell Alaska's big game for consumptive use, those being the guided hunt industry and the transporting industry. We rely on the allocation process that the Board of Game represents per legislative direction. And so the Board of Game process for us is an absolutely essential component to how we not just interact with the resource, but how we interact with the public and the decision makers here in this state. Hunting guides live across the state. Many of them live in rural Alaska. There's a strong correlation to where a person lives to where the economic benefits are realized in the community that they live in. So when hunting guides live in rural areas, the economic benefit tends to be close to where they live, and vice versa. If they live out of state, for instance, the economic benefit would be in whatever community they live in out of state. We're very fortunate. About 90% of Alaska's hunting guides, and at least that percentage of our members, are Alaska residents. So there's a very strong relationship between Alaska residency and the guide industry. We have strong support for Nate Turner on the board. He is an active registered hunting guide, but when you're an active commercial user in these kind of formats, you're held to a very, very high standard in the public eye, because if you come forward representing just a commercial interest or don't have the ability to balance competing views, you quickly lose credibility in the eyes of the public, just as a guide loses credibility in the eyes of the public if he's irresponsible in the field. We're proud to have Mr. Turner on the board as a guide because we feel that he's done a good job reaching out to the public and building support within the general public sector on how those perspectives are perceived. And we think that one of the things that we contribute to society, while we have the ability to profit from a publicly owned resource, we also have unique expertise or knowledge that are supposed to come back and benefit the public as a whole. We think Mr. Turner represents a link in that chain. I'll say that the guide industry in Alaska right now is very challenged. We have some significant issues on federal land, and then of course with the discussion on the state budget and how the state's going to approach managing its resources, those things are very concerning for our members and the industry as a whole, and we think should be concerning for legislators and the governor and everyone else involved. I'll give you an example of some of the really important challenges that face the guide industry, and that having someone like Nate Turner involved in, we see as a positive thing for the state as a whole. There's two rule processes. The Park Service passed a rule, a new regulatory change that alters the authority and the relationship between the federal government and the state. U.S. Fish and Wildlife has a similarly proposed rule. In the arguments for their decision, they're arguing using the Board of Game process, our process, let's say, against ourselves. And having a conscientious person that builds a good record gives the state better standing and a better chance at resisting these types of things in the future. So having a member on the board, or multiple members, or hopefully a whole board, that has the ability to lay down a record and make its decisions based on sustained yield and its mandates, give the state a strong future moving forward if we're to argue against those actions. The third issue that the state is struggling with, and the Board of Game will be forced to address, is the BLM is moving forward with a limitation on guides on its lands now. We thought we had more time when the concession program failed here in the legislature. BLM's moving faster than what we thought. The Obama administration is, of course, winding down. We fear executive action there. The importance of the Board of Game in that process is, even though you can't create, you can't synthesize the positive benefits of a concession program with the Board of Game, at least having a sensitive member on the board when they have to make resource decisions to try to do as little harm as possible, where you can still accomplish the resource goal and draft a good regulation, is very important. Having Mr. Turner on the board is absolutely essential from our perspective on that, just working through the regulatory process and doing as little harm as possible. So from those perspectives, we offer strong support. That will rest our testimony.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Stacey. Questions for Mr. Stacey? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stacey, I just wanted to make sure I heard right. I find it's valuable to have a guide on the board, but doesn't Mr. Turner have to recuse himself from most activities that would benefit himself for the guiding activity? General knowledge of maybe? I just want to clarify this on the record. It's not because he's a vote for the guides, but that he has a broader knowledge. I want to make sure I've interpreted correctly and correct any inferences, correct or not, that I might have made about that.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I'm not the final. He has to recuse himself, and he often recuses himself when decisions will directly benefit or could be construed to benefit him financially. I've been to Board of Game meetings where Mr. Turner has recused himself. I've watched the process. So the direct vote up or down from our perspective on a guide issue is not as important as having the perspective sometimes in the deliberation or how the board approaches a problem. Sometimes the up or down vote is secondary to just elevating the level of discussion on an issue from a different perspective, we would say.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then I have inferred correctly that it was the broader knowledge, not that he was a vote. Because some listening might have thought, well, he's a Board of Games guy on the vote, but he can't necessarily vote with you just by following the stricture of ethics and his own personal ethics. But it's his general knowledge that you find useful, that he brings a broader perspective to the board.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I think that that's absolutely correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That helped me clarify, and I I just want to make sure this is a public record on things, and nobody is safe from any misinterpretations from when we get to the floor, and not as much debate takes place on the floor. So thank you for that indulgence.
Absolutely. I appreciate the question, Senator Stoltz. Further questions for Mr. Stacey? All right. Seeing none, thank you. Is there anyone else in the room or online who wishes to testify on this appointment? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony. And Senator Stoltz, I'd like to take that discussion, the last question you asked about recusing, conflict of interest, et cetera, and Mr. Turner is still on the line. Why don't we ask him to answer that question? Mr. Turner?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, very clearly. If you would again introduce yourself for the record, and did you hear Senator Stoltz's question, and could you respond to it?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Again, for the record, my name is Nate Turner, current vice chairman of the Board of Game. This is a topic that I take quite seriously. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was 8 or 9 years before my first time on the Board of Game that another active registered guide had sat at the table. And I had seen some of the confirmation processes, I'd witnessed it, and I learned learned even before I was on the board how important it is to have a very transparent disclosure of what your interests are and how you may be affected by any decisions that are made. Before each meeting, I've obviously studied the proposals. I outline them at the beginning of the meeting, usually during my ethics disclosure. And I also add the caveat that if any unforeseen thing arises during a meeting, that I would request at that time to be recused from deliberating on a topic or a proposal. Obviously, all of our board actions are part of the public record, and we're watched by many, of course. And I think there's no one that could find fault with my sensitivity towards this topic. There's times even where I knew I could not benefit or even be harmed by a topic that we were discussing, but I was aware that the general public might have the perception that I could be just because I'm a guide, and I even asked to be recused from those deliberations, sometimes contrary to the advice of legal counsel at the table and the chairman, who didn't see conflict. I'd rather just stay above accusation, both for my own sake and for the benefit of the board's work.
Very good. Senator Stoltz.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't really trying to probe anything. I've observed Mr. Turner's action on the Board of the Game, and I get an ethical person actually exceeds and surpasses any written law or stricture that we put on, and I think he's very well explained that. I wanted to clarify, just to make sure that, I think when Mr. Stacey, he was representing a certain industry, and certainly they support him, but I wanted to elaborate that I think I heard what I did, but others might not have, that his breadth of experience and ethics far was beyond the limits of one aspect of game management in Alaska. So, and I'm glad it's all on the record now, and again, Mr. Turner's public record speaks more than any adherence to or pledge to follow some written structure. I mean, the proof is how he has personally conducted it, and that's notwithstanding his other knowledge. That's a high standard that I really respect. When you do the right thing, even when you don't think anybody's watching. So, thank you for your service, Mr. Turner.
Yeah, thank you for the comments, and if I might reply to that, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would. I forgot my thought. I agree with your sentiment, and I'm actually glad that you brought up the topic, because this is something that you do hear from the public at times, concern that it actually troubles me a little bit to be called a commercial operator. I've always been adverse to that term. I don't guide for money, although I obviously earn my living from it, but that's not what motivates me to be a guide or a trapper. But but because of the sensitivity of these topics, I'm really glad that this discussion came up today. And those are comments that do come forward at times, you know, that there's a, that it may be inappropriate that a guide is sitting on the board or, in comparison to the fish board, there's actually a noted absence of commercial interest on the board of game. So that's all I'll say.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. I would call out also, you know, when people are applying for these boards and commissions, there is an application they fill out, and after they fill out their personal information, there is a section, Conflict of Interest. And Mr. Turner did answer very clearly the section that says, please explain the potential financial benefit, and he calls out the fact that he's very careful to recuse himself at the appropriate times. So for anyone who misses this meeting and is wondering, this application is online also. Any further questions for Mr. Turner? All right. Seeing none, then we will submit a committee report. In accordance with AS 3905080, the Resources Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Board of Game, Nathan Turner, Ninana. Appointment 5-10-2010, reappointed 7-1-2013, reappointed 7-1-2016. Term expires 6-30-2019. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. There is a document that the committee will sign. We'll take a brief at ease while that's taking place. We're back on the record. At this time, we'll take up Senate Bill 164. This is a bill from the administration, and it deals with penalties for fish and game licenses, among other items. We welcome the two presenters. We have Bruce Dale from Fish and Game, Major Brad Chaston from the Department of Public Safety. For questions, we have Kevin Brooks from Fish and Game, Casey Schroeder from Law, and Aaron Peterson also from Law, it looks like. And Leah, I think I've got everybody, is that true? All right. Well, in any case, welcome to the committee, gentlemen, if you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed to present the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bernard Chastain, and I'm a major with the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. I'm the deputy director. And to my right here, I have Bruce Dale. I'll let him introduce himself.
I'm Bruce Dale. I'm the director of wildlife conservation for the Department of Fish and Game. And Major Chastain will be presenting most of the information today. I'm here for questions mostly.
Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Major Chastain, again, I'd like to amend a few people on the phone here. I have a couple lifelines on the phone today. So I have John Skidmore as the director of the criminal division on the line. Aaron Peterson was not able to make it today. I also have Seth Bosang with the attorney general's office, who's the advisor for the board of game. And Kevin Brooks is in the room as well. So we should be able to answer most questions today.
Good. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if it pleases the committee, I'd like to walk through the sexual analysis that we've done and kind of talk about each section. Some of them can be combined together. I think we can move through some of the sections rather quickly, but some of them might have some discussion. So I'll just start in the beginning if you like.
That'd be great. Thank you.
So the first portion of this bill is section one, and that's under AS 1605-330. A person engaged in activities listed in 1 through 5 in this section must have in their actual possession a license, tag, or permit to legally engage in that activity. Section 1 reorders these activities into two separate categories, and 1 and 2 are considered general activities, that's sport fishing, hunting, and trapping, while sections 3, 4, and 5 are commercial activities. And the purpose for these for this amendment is contained in section 3 of this bill. So we'll get to that in a second. Section 2 amends 1605.330 to D Delta to make it unlawful for a person to purchase a license in this or another state if their license to hunt, fish, or trap has been revoked or suspended in this or another state. Currently, the statute directs that if a person's license is suspended or revoked, they are prohibited from purchasing or using the privileges of that license only in another state. Surprisingly, this does not include the state of Alaska. So this change will actually align the statute with the intent of the law.
Senator Wilkowski.
So just to clarify, if you're, for some reason, banned from hunting, would that prohibit you from getting a sport fishing license or just a hunting license, I assume?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, normally the way it works is dependent upon the activity that you're revoked or suspended from. So if you're suspended from sport fishing in another state or this state, you're prohibited from purchasing a sport fishing license in this or another state.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
How is it that people who are banned from getting sport fishing license, let's say, in this state able to get licenses? I mean, is that happening? Or is this just a hypothetical event that you're trying to prohibit?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that does happen. So a good example would be someone who is revoked or suspended in another state comes to Alaska and purchases a license when they're suspended in that state. We currently have a wildlife violators compact that establishes reciprocity with a number of states across the U.S., and that prohibits that person from utilizing the privileges of that license. What this does is it prohibits them from purchasing it. So if they're suspended or revoked in another state, they cannot come to Alaska and purchase the like license.
Yes, follow-up, Senator.
But that's what the current law says. You're changing to this state. You're saying if you're suspended in, as I'm reading this, if you're suspended in this state, you can't get a sport fishing license, which, of course, you can't get a sport fishing license if you're suspended. I mean, do we really need to specify this? And just help me out here.
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, what it prohibits is it prohibits the use of a sport fishing license. It does not prohibit you purchasing the license. So the problem is, when a wildlife trooper or another law enforcement officer is checking a sport fisherman, we have no way of knowing whether they're suspended or revoked at that time. And so it actually, it's a crime. If you're suspended in another state, it's a crime to come to Alaska, but it's not a crime if you're suspended in Alaska right now. So we're adding this state as the crime to purchase the license.
Hmm. Okay. Take your word for it.
Senator Matucci had a question.
I was going to wait till you went through the whole bill, but I have a little bit of a concern on you haven't gotten to Section 3. I'll wait till you review Section 3. That's my first question. Sorry, Madam Chair.
No worries. All right, I don't see any other questions on Section 2, so I'll let you go on to Section 3.
Madam Chair. Section 3, this bill makes it an official correctable citation to not have your sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license in actual possession. And so if you remember, we reordered in Section 1, we reordered sport fishing, hunting, and trapping in the first two portions of that. So we realize, lots of wildlife troopers realize that sometimes people forget their hunting and fishing licenses at home. Sometimes they leave them in their car. Sometimes they don't have them exactly on them. So in that scenario, the law requires that they have a license right now in possession to participate in those things. And so the law states that we need to cite that person if they don't have that license. So what this does, it actually makes it an official correctable citation so that if they forgot their license at home, but they have prior purchased that license before they went fishing, that it becomes a correctable citation. And that means that that someone can, that person can bring their correctable citation to any office of DPS, Alaska Wildlife Troopers, and have it signed off when they show that they have a valid license before that they were cited. And if that happens, it becomes a correctable, and that's like headlight requirements or proof of insurance requirements, becomes an official correctable citation.
Very good. Senator Machicki had a question.
So I support just generally the concepts in Section 3. I have a problem with three words. Those three words are tag or permit. I don't understand how a tag can be correctable. If you're charged with not having your license, great. I had a license, easy enough. But if my tag is not punched, we know about folks that have creatively harvested more than their game species by not punching a tag. So that is a major problem in this change. Do you have a response for that, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, I'll start here, and then maybe Director Bruce Dale might have a few words on that as well. But there is also another possibility, and that possibility is that under regulation, they're required to notch their harvest ticket. They're required to have that in possession when they do that. So if they don't have their tag in their possession and they have an animal, we have another problem. That's a violation in and of itself. And so in this situation, if we contacted somebody that had, maybe they hadn't taken an animal yet and they were just hunting and they didn't have that, we could make that an official correctable citation. We just need to say to them, you need to make sure you have that in your possession. If you have a tag that you left in your car or have a permit that you left somewhere, you can produce that and we'll make that a correctable citation.
Follow-up, Senator Machicki?
We'll chat with Department of Law, I think, about that. I think there are still issues with tag or permit. Maybe it's something you hadn't thought of or not, and I don't expect you to cover that right now, but the license is easy. It becomes more challenging with particularly a tag that should have been punched. But.
Mr. Dale, did you have a response?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Bruce Dale, Director of Wildlife Conservation. We actually gave this a considerable amount of thought, and we thought in the case where somebody forgot their license or dropped it in the lake or whatever, and tag and permit or harvest ticket, that if they were approached by enforcement officer and asked what they're doing, I'm hunting sheep under this permit, can I see it? And I don't have it. Well, they're supposed to carry it with them if they're hunting sheep. So we thought that would be correctable, like the license was, but that would also be, we would have to make it clear that under separate regulations that are not correctable, you must affix your locking tag, you must validate your harvest ticket. So those regulations are not correctable. So if somebody takes an animal, they still are guilty of those violations, and that makes the chain of being able to show that they harvested an animal and comply with the other regulations intact. But the simple person who just forgets, can't find their tag on them, that is correctable.
Follow-up, Senator Machicki. We do have law on the line, if you would like to inquire of them.
Well, just to follow up, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not illegal to hike around in the mountains with a rifle, right? It becomes an issue when you take an animal. We want to make sure there's no confusion in this, in the code, that might make someone believe they have not contacted Fish and Game, but they lost getting off the airplane, they dropped everything in the water, and they think it's correctable. They think they can just call it in that they've taken an animal but really don't have what they need to hunt. I just have some concerns that it could be confusing if they believe that's a correctable violation.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I'd be happy to relook.
If you could identify yourself for the record, Mr. Chastain, the secretary needs to record all this.
Certainly. For the record, Major Chastain with the Wildlife Troopers, through the chair, Senator Machicki, we'd be happy to look at this again, and I don't know that has to be the way it is. We're trying to just affect it all together in one piece, so we'd be glad to look at it.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Section F, line 19, says a person charged with violating
A1 or 2 of the section may not be convicted if the person produces in court or in the office of the arresting or citing officer. And I'm just envisioning a scenario of someone's from Anchorage, they go out to Western Alaska, they're cited by someone from Western Alaska. The specific language of this, the court's probably going to be Western Alaska, probably Bethel or somewhere, and then the arresting officer might be based somewhere out there. Would it be possible to change that so that the person could go down to Fish and Game over on Raspberry Road or somewhere in Anchorage or Fairbanks, let's say? Or is it important that they go to the office of the arresting or citing officer?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the intent here is that they could go to any office of the issuing agency. So they could go to any Alaska Wildlife Trooper office and have it signed off. Because of the nature of these things, we don't want to clog the court system with having them go to the court to have a clerk of the court look at that. They may not really realize what they're looking at when they're going through that. So we would prefer that they come like other correctable citations to the office of the issuing agency. And that's any office around the state.
Thank you. For the record, that was Mr. Chastain. Further questions on Section 3? All right, seeing none, we can go on to 4.
This is Major Chastain with the Wildlife Troopers. Section 4 removes a correctable citation section under 1605.330F from the penalties portion of the statute, and it aligns other areas of Title 16 and appropriately makes the crimes listed Class A misdemeanors. And there'll be more about that here as we go along.
Okay.
Section 5 of this bill creates two new subsections. Subsection C establishes that a person may be charged with a violation offense if there's no culpable mental state established, and it maintains a misdemeanor offense for more serious cases under subsection A. And subsection D provides the court with the ability to impose additional restitution to the state equal to the amount of lost federal matching funds from the Wildlife and Sport Fish Restoration Program, Pittman-Robertson and Dingell-Johnson-Wallop Borough Programs, when the state is defrauded by a defendant who does not purchase the appropriate license or tag or claims residency when they are not a resident. So I think what I'll do is I'll explain briefly what that means, and then I'll have Director Dale talk about the PR fund shortly. So in this scenario, what we're talking about is non-residents coming to Alaska and purchasing resident licenses. And oftentimes what we find is, in investigation, this has happened over a period of years often, and they not only purchase a hunting license and a fishing license, but they get dip net permits and they get locking tags and they shoot a brown bear and they go doll sheep hunting. And by the time we catch up with them, that has added up over time, and they've defrauded the state of Alaska, not only in the cost difference between the resident license versus the non-resident license and the tags differences, but also in the Pittman-Robertson funds and the funds that the state of Alaska gets from the federal government. So I'll let Director Dale talk about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bruce Dale, Director of Wildlife Conservation. The state's Fish and Game Fund, which is the receipts from hunting and trapping licenses and tags, are matched with the federal program, the Wildlife Sport Fish Restoration Program, at a rate of $3 federal dollars for every dollar that we match it with the Fish and Game Fund. And the concept of this change is that over time, we not only lose the value of the license that the person should have bought, but we also lose the ability to leverage that into federal funds. And so this provides the court a way in appropriate cases to restore some of those funds.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, thank you. As we're wading through this, I'm trying to hear about the sections. Is this a revenue bill? Is this a deterrence bill? Is it, we're dealing with all kinds of those vehicles. I see there's an excising of the jail sentences and the fines and into Class A misdemeanors. Maybe I missed it in your introduction, but the overlying theme with the motive or motives are and might help me better understand this even better than a sectional analysis. How much of it is it partially revenue? Is it partially restorative justice? Is it partially keeping our jails unclogged? We're hearing a lot about that stuff. So maybe if the chair doesn't mind.
Sure.
Madam Chair, Deputy Director Chastain for the Wildlife Troopers. So I think the important thing here is there's three portions to this. First is there's a couple housekeeping issues where we're actually fixing statute to reflect, we believe, what the intent is. The second portion of that is there, as we'll get to in a second, there's an increase of restitution amounts, so they come into basically where the levels are in today's dollars. And the third portion of that is we are making these statutes more flexible, so that and I'll talk to that in a second about all these that are listed here will have the ability to be a Class A misdemeanor or charged as a violation. And so what that does is it gives us more flexibility in determining if it's not as serious an offense, we can charge it as a violation. If it is a very serious offense, we still have the ability to charge it as a Class A misdemeanor.
Follow-up, Senator Stoltz.
Have you, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I heard part of that, it's restorative justice. Is that a correct assumption? Or is that the correct reading?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, that is portion of the bill, correct?
Okay. We're talking about inflation proofing theft and felony activities. Have you looked at an inflation index for this so you don't have to? And that's, I haven't talked about that. Others have. You see a mechanism for providing for escalating values or de-escalating values, depending on what the commodities market is on these things.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, we haven't considered that, no, sir.
Thank you.
I had a question. So I understand that not all the Fish and Game funds get matching federal funds. I assume you've taken that into account in the fiscal note.
Bruce Dale, Director of Wildlife Conservation. Yes, Madam Chair, I'm sure that's been accounted for in the fiscal note, and yes, you're correct that not all the Fish and Game Fund gets matched. There's some things that the match is not appropriate for, and we use straight Fish and Game Fund for. One is law enforcement, another is regulations. So some of these things directly would not be used as matched. However, when at the court's discretion, this would be used where it was appropriate, where there was a long series of violations, that's when it would be applied. So it probably wouldn't be applied in 100% of the cases or even the majority of cases. So it's hard to predict exactly how often it'll be used with this change, but it would be easier for the courts with this change to retrieve some of those lost revenues from the federal government with this change.
Okay. Senator Machicki.
I'm assuming that these are expected to be fairly small quantities of dollars. It's largely kind of figurative more than has any real value to it. Is that correct? I mean, even a long-standing, if you went 10 years without a license and it was discovered, would be a relatively small quantity of restitution to the state.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, this is Major Chastain. It can be, most of the time, the cases are fairly small quantities, but there are several cases per year that are in the tens of thousands of dollars, and that results from multiple years of abuse of that resident privilege. For instance, they get multiple resident harvest tickets, and where they should have actually purchased a non-resident license and multiple non-resident locking tags. And those range from, brown bear locking tag, I think, is $500. And so as you look at that, that $500 is then matched 3-to-1 by PR funds.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions on this section? All right. Seeing none, I'll let you go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Major Chastain, for Section 6, this increases the strict liability commercial fishing fines under 1605-722. And this section was enacted in 1988 and has gone unchanged since then. The fines that are currently in place are inadequate to deter commercial fishing crime for strict liability offenses. The fine increase will serve both as a deterrent and a tool for Alaska Wildlife Troopers to effectively enforce the state's most important fisheries worth billions of dollars, and ensures that more commercial fishermen can participate in the fisheries by deterring illegal fishing that harms the industry. And as a side note, you'll notice that the fines have gone up for strict liability from $3,000 to $6,000 in that section one. $3,000 in 1988 dollars equals about $6,050 in 2016. So it's nearly the same across the board since from 1988 dollars.
Okay, Senator Machicki.
I'm assuming, and I you're kind of giving me the answer I wanted, but and I'm just going to jump forward to Section 16 for 1 second, Madam Chair. I assume those 50% increases are simply because of the same adjustment. I think those changed in 95, the last bail schedule for game. Is that correct? Or was that 2008? Do you know the year for the last time the game bail schedule changed?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, my research showed 1996 is when that was enacted.
Okay, so the adjustment is same 2016 dollars, and it's 50% here and approximately 100% for the commercial numbers, which passed in 88.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I actually did not do that for the restitution amounts. We certainly could, though. We could apply that across that section 16 if you'd like.
Well, Mike,
follow up.
When you talked about the inflation adjusted from 88, it's about $6,000. So the bail schedule for the wildlife as well in section 16 looks like a similar adjustment because that bail schedule was revised fairly recently, 96 versus 88. Looks like these would be a higher number, but I'm just trying to keep it sort of consistent across the board. It's something we can look at later. I support the increases, by the way.
Further questions on Section 6? I had a question. Do these fines go into the general fund or into fish and game funds?
Madam Chair, the strict liability fines themselves go to the general fund. And I have also Director Skidmore online if he needs to correct me, but I'm nearly certain they go into the general fund.
All right. Mr. Skidmore, did you want to clarify that answer?
Madam Chair, this is John Skidmore. I'm the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. The fines that you find in Section 6 of the bill would, in fact, go into the general fund. That's to be contrasted to the restitution amounts found in Section 16, which would be for the Fish and Game Fund.
Okay, let me just make note of that. Goes to Fish and Game. How about the PR fund, the PR fines, the matching funds that would have to be reimbursed, potentially, if they were lost? Those go to Fish and Game or the general fund?
Madam Chair, this is John Skidmore again. Those funds actually go into the Fish and Game Fund. The federal matching funds are earmarked to be used for purposes of conservation, so they couldn't simply go into the general fund.
Thank you for clarifying. Further questions? Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you. On Section 6, on the violations in that, you know, we take away people's professional license for activities totally unrelated to their conduct within their profession, child support or other activities. Has there been any consideration about if the fines don't work, maybe for multiple suspensions or multiple offenses, suspending a person's privilege to access that commonly owned resource? And can you describe any, if it's maybe that's in another section of the law?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, this is Major Chastain. Thank you for that question. That's a good question. These are strict liability offenses, which means that they're strictly liable for the offense, regardless of that intent. So, under these circumstances, we do not have to prove what's considered a culpable mental state in proving that they were in violation of this. We still have the ability to charge commercial fishing violations as a misdemeanor. And in those situations, when the case is serious, we bring it before a court, and we do ask the court to deal with their license themselves or their permit. In addition to that, when they're charged as a misdemeanor for certain offenses, they can accrue points through the CFEC, and just like a driver's license, they get a certain number of points, and their permit can be suspended for a period of time.
Follow-up, Senator Stoltz.
No, I accomplished my mission in getting that on the record. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. All right. I see no more questions for Section 6. We can go on to 7.
Okay, Madam Chair, Major Chastain. Section 7 creates a new subsection, requires that the court transmit commercial fishing convictions to CFEC. And just like I mentioned a second ago to Senator Stoltz, the importance of misdemeanor commercial fishing cases, they accrue points on their permits, and so it's important that the court transmit those to CFEC so that they can keep track of those and take the appropriate action.
Good. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. The governor recently issued some sort of proclamation transferring some duties of CFEC to the Department of Fish and Game. Is that impacted? Is there any necessity to transmit notice to Fish and Game also?
Madam Chair, Bruce Dale, Director of Wildlife for Fish and Game. No, the CFEC will still remain a separate entity, so this will not affect this section. Most of the transfer and absorption of functions of CFEC is limited to IT and licensing, things like that, administration. They remain a separate entity.
Further questions on Section 7?
I'm sorry.
Seeing none. We can go on to 8.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Major Chastain. So I'm going to take sections 8 through 15 all together and discuss them, as they're generally the same thing. What that does is it standardizes across the board violations to make them consistent and creates them all as a class of misdemeanor, which is Class A misdemeanors. But it also provides for a mechanism for us to charge each one of those as violations if appropriate. And so right now in statute, there's no mechanism to charge as violations. So when we deal with these under statute, when we come across one of these crimes, we don't have a way to deal with them on a lighter hand. We only have a Class A misdemeanor to deal with them. So this would enable us to, when appropriate, charge them as a violation, and when appropriate, to charge them as a Class A misdemeanor.
Senator Wilkowski.
Explain, so maybe explain the interrelationship between Section 8 and Section 9. If you take a brown bear, a grizzly bear within half a mile of solid waste disposal facility, currently it's a Class A misdemeanor. Under this, it would be a violation. And what's the fine for that? And then explain the interrelationship, if you could, with Section 9, because that talks about an additional fine of up to $10,000.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that's actually there's quite a bit of question there. So let me start with the first part, and I may need to ask on lifeline here for a second. But so Section 8 actually creates is amended to create a section that standardizes, removes the Class A misdemeanor, and makes it a violation offense if we cannot prove a culpable mental state. It's still a misdemeanor if it's intentional, or if we can prove that they knew that the solid waste disposal facility was there. So it does the same thing. It just amends it in a different way than some of the other ones have. Section 9, that portion was put in place by the legislature. I'm not sure why they chose to address 782B in that manner, but they at the time they must have felt differently than other statutes, because they made it very clear that it was a $10,000 fine, additional $10,000 fine. So I'm not sure why that was put in place.
Senator Wilkowski.
Maybe law can explain, and then maybe you can direct me to the part of the statute that says if you have a culpable state, then you can be guilty of a criminal violation like a misdemeanor.
We have two folks from law online. Would you like to call on one of them, Mr. Chastain?
Through the chair, Major Chastain, I'll address the first question here, and then I think I'll ask the Department of Law to comment. Section 9, the additional penalty, as is pointed out to me by Director Dale, is for when that person fails to salvage that animal. It's an additional can be up to an additional $10,000 fine.
Was that a complete answer to your question, Senator Wilkowski?
Well, I'm just, okay, so I appreciate that clarification. Thank you. Let's go to Section 8 then. Mm-hmm. A person who, so currently the law is, must be criminal negligence. You're making that basically strict liability. You take a grizzly within half mile, you're guilty. But you then said there were, you could still be guilty if you did it with some sort of culpable mind. And I'm trying to figure out what section of the law you're relying on for that statement. And then I'm trying to figure out what the penalty is if you violate 782A.
Through the chair, I think I'll ask if Casey Schroeder is available online.
Casey Schroeder is here in the room. Welcome, Ms. Schroeder.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe that you're asking for where the penalty provisions are for Section 8.
I want to know, if I could, Madam Chair.
Yes,
I want to know what the penalty is under the new Section 8, and then I want to know if you do it with a culpable mind, intentionally, recklessly, what is there a criminal penalty to that, a misdemeanor, felony, something of that nature?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, both the answers to both of your questions are found in Section 10 of the bill. So if you act with criminal negligence, it's a Class A misdemeanor, and if you have no culpable mental state, it's a violation.
Okay, ma'am.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Is there a, if you don't act with criminal negligence but act with, let's say, recklessness or intentional, you intentionally do it, do you fall under that section as well?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, you would. Criminal negligence is the lowest mental state required, so anything above that would be the same.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Schroeder? All right.
Thank you.
Oh, pardon me. Senator Stoltz?
As long as law is at the table, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I had a question on Section 11 and on the forfeitures. I think it was Section 11. And does this make any changes to, I guess, what folks call administrative forfeitures and forfeitures before a presumption of guilt? And that's I've heard some talk in the building about suggested changes to that statute. I haven't seen specific legislation, but that's, can you just describe the whole forfeiture process? And is it only after a court action that, as it describes in this statute, or are there other circumstances where forfeitures are made, and what's the process?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, Section 11 itself does not make any changes to the forfeiture statute or the forfeiture process. For a more detailed description of how the forfeiture process works, I'd like to defer to John Skidmore, the Director of the Criminal Division.
Mr. Skidmore.
This is John Skidmore. Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, the answer to your question, Ms. Schroeder first described to you that this statute does not change anything in the law. The aircraft or the equipment used is only done after a conviction in a case. The forfeiture, I believe, that you're referring to, Senator Stoltz, is forfeiture that is done of meat. And in those cases, when meat is seized in a case, because of the constitutional provisions requiring that all game in the state of Alaska be used to the greatest benefit of the citizens, and because these cases often can take a significant period of time to come to resolution, there is a practice that is supported through the interpretation of the law that allows the meat to be given to those who can consume it so that it is not itself wasted, and then later, should that taking of the meat have deemed to have been inappropriate, then it is replaced with an equal quantity of meat from the person from whom it was taken.
follow-up, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I asked the question inartfully. Is the equipment, who takes possession of it? I know there might be the legal process of forfeiture, but does the person lose stewardship of it for any time prior to him conviction or disposition of the court case?
Through the Chair, Major Chastain, Senator Stoltz. So equipment you're speaking to directly is seized under a criminal seizure warrant issued by a judge, and it's held pending court until the judge decides what happens with that item. There is a provision which allows for someone to come to the court, which they can do under what I believe is called a remission hearing. And in that scenario, they can come to the court and portray to the court why their item should be returned to them. If the court decides that it needs to be held, the judge has that ability.
Follow-up, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the clarification because it was a little bit different than the first answer, that it's only forfeited after the finding of guilt through a criminal disposition, but it's a little more complicated than that. And it, as you described in the case of Meat, it could take quite a while. Not that an airplane is going to go bad, but it could be quite a while that it's held in that pre-conviction forfeiture. That a nod doesn't come across very well in the record.
Madam Chair, Senator Stoltz, it varies depending upon lots of different things. For instance, the length of time that a case takes to get to court, the number of motions filed by both sides, depends on a lot of different things, court calendar and availability of lots of different scenarios.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions in this section we're going through, 9 through 15, 8 through 15? Any further questions?
Madam Chair, may I be excused?
Yes, thank you very much, Ms. Schroeder. Yeah, get out of here as soon as you can. All right, I don't see any further questions, so we can go on, I believe, Section 16.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Major Chastain. Section 16, this section increases restitution amounts by 50% that a person convicted of unlawfully taking big game may have to pay to the state if the court so chooses to implement this restitution. Alaska's game belongs to all of us collectively. When a big game animal is unlawfully taken, it defrauds the state of the value of that animal to its citizens. The value varies greatly depending on the species of animal, the location of the take, the social value of the animal, the economic value of the animal, and the food source value to the people of the state. These restitution values may be imposed by a judge if the judge believes that it warrants applying restitution in addition to the fine. In most cases, it does not make the state whole for the loss of the animal, but it does help pay the state back in some measure. As an example of this, several years ago, a very large doll sheep was illegally shot on the Seward Highway south of Anchorage. This area is closed to hunting for doll sheep. That animal was worth an unknown amount of money to the state and tourism, amount some money. Many thousands of people took photos of the sheep. There are many examples like this every year where the illegally taken resource may never be fully recovered by the state. So this is an ability for the judge to impose additional amounts above and beyond what the fine is as far as restitution, and that restitution, like Director Skidmore addressed, goes back to the Fish and Game Fund.
Very good questions on Section 16. No. Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, that answer, there was a subjective value put on there. I guess that's existing law. So if the lion had a name and people were fond of it, an internationally known case, or if somebody is calls the sheep by a name, and does that subjectivity end, and that does become like a little bit of a beachhead for the non-consumptive users? You've just put some things on the record about subjective values of game. It's more of a comment, Madam Chair.
Senator Stoltz, thank you. Senator Wilkowski had a question.
Yeah. Okay, can you explain this to me? So Section 11, the current law is if you violate that provision, you are guilty of a misdemeanor, and upon conviction, punishable by a fine of not more than $5,000 or by imprisonment for not more than a year or both. You're taking out the fine provision there, correct? So are you you're making the law less of a penalty, or do you change it somewhere else?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Actually, what that does is it just cleans that section up. I know it doesn't look like it on paper here, but the Class A misdemeanor is the penalty. So the penalty of a Class A misdemeanor is $10,000 and a year in jail.
Gotcha. So if I could, Madam Chair.
Yes,
so under the way it's currently written, we were actually lowering the amount of penalty that you could collect from 10 to 5, and now you're releasing that provision. And under some other section that's not cited here, the court can go ahead because by virtue of a Class A misdemeanor can fine the person up to $10,000. Correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that's correct. Right.
Thank you.
Good. Further questions? All right, seeing none, we can move on to 17.
So there are two drafting errors in the document here that I want to bring the attention to the committee. Madam Chair, the first one here is in Section 17, and that should actually say under Section 17, instead of 1605.925, which is what it reads now, it should read AS1605.901. And the reason for that is that between AS1605.871 and AS1605.896, the penalty provision for that is 901. So we want to make sure that that's clear up front.
Thank you. Any questions about the content of Section 17? All right, going on to 18.
Madam Chair, Major Chastain, Section 18 adds a definition of electronic form. And prior in this section, it talked about that they may show it in electronic form. This actually just creates a definition of what electronic form means. I'll let Director Dale speak to that.
Director Bruce Dale from the Division of Wildlife Conservation, Fish and Game. The Division of Wildlife, at least, and I think the Division of Sport Fish, currently don't have any electronic license forms. This would enable it to be done in the future. Currently, the regulations, especially for wildlife, which I'm more familiar with, and some sport fish, require that either something is recorded on a harvest on a license or validated on a permit or a harvest ticket. So those, by regulation now, require hard copies. But in the future, there'll be technological issues that we can solve in terms of being able to validate them on your personal device or whatever. There's a lot of demand and interest in having those things on personal devices rather than paper. And so this change would simply enable those changes in the future. And this may be especially useful for things like people that buy non-resident one-day or three-day fishing licenses or something like that, who can get them and have them in hand and not have to get to a printer and spend half a day on a charter boat somewhere.
Cool. So there'll be an app for that?
There'll be an app for that, Madam Chair.
Cool. Any questions? Senator Machicki.
I'm sorry. I've got my statute here. I'm just back to Section 17. That is all in reference to Article 8. Violations under Article 8, is that correct? The protection of waterways for anadromous fish?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, Major Chastain. So at 1605.871 through 896, if I look at that here, 871 is Article 8, which is protection of waterways for anadromous fish. And 871 is protection of fish and game. 881 is construction without approval prohibited. And 891, it goes on through that section.
And
Senator Machicki.
Can you just clarify if it's punishable under AS 1255, what that means and what kind of a change that represents?
Through the chair, I think I'd like to ask Director Skidmore if he's able to address that.
Absolutely. Director Skidmore.
Sorry about that. I think my line's unmuted now for you all.
Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you now. Thank you.
Great. This is John Skidmore. I'm the Director of the Criminal Division. So previously, Alaska Statute 60, I'm sorry, through the chair, Senator Machicki, the answer to your question is Statute 1605.896 indicated that offenses were punishable as a misdemeanor currently for those various sections. And what Section 17 of the bill does is that it allows a violation to be charged instead of a misdemeanor. And the violation under under 1255 would be punishable up to $500.
Senator Machiki, follow-up?
So would you say that's a fairly significant reduction in the level of charge? I'm not sure I have all the legalese, but...
This is John Skidmore again, through the chair. Senator, the answer to your question is we're not reducing it from a misdemeanor to a violation. A misdemeanor is still a appropriate way in which to charge it, but this is consistent with what's happened throughout the bill when there is no culpable mental state, that is no mens rea, that it could be charged as a violation. That's an easier way to prove the case without having to show that mental state, which is why there is also a lower penalty as a result. But if there is an appropriate mental state, it remains a misdemeanor, punishable the same way as it was previously, sir.
Perfect. Thank you, ma'am.
All right. Thank you. All right. No further questions on 17 or 18. We'll move on to 19.
Through the chair, it's Major Chastain again. So, section 18 we already discussed. Sections 19 through 26, I'm going to take all in one chunk.
Thank you.
They generally standardize the penalties in the statutes as we have done throughout the bill. So it creates standardization for charging as misdemeanors, but also gives the ability to charge as a violation when appropriate. All these sections do that throughout the bill.
Question on these sections? All right, seeing none.
Madam Chair, Section 27 actually amends the court rule, which allows us to create a correctable citation. So right now there's no mechanism in place to make a correctable citation. This would be that mechanism, so that if this passed, that the mechanism would be in place to create an official correctable citation under 1605.330 for not having your license in possession.
Okay. Questions on Section 27? All right. Section 28.
Madam Chair, this is Major Chastain. Section 28 amends the uncodified law of Alaska to make it clear that the Act applies to offenses that occur on or after the effective date, and Section 29 provides for the effective date of July 1st, 2016.
Thank you, Mr. Chastain. You had mentioned earlier that there were two typos in this bill, but you've only told us about one in Section 17. What was the other one?
Madam Chair, thank you for reminding me. I skipped right over it. So it would be under Section 23.
Okay.
And it'll be line number 9. And right now it reads 16.10.010, and it should say 16.10.110.
Very good. Great. Thank you for that. So that concludes the sectional on the bill. Questions from committee members? All right. Senator Machiki, you look like you're formulating a question.
I have a question, Madam Chair. Just on the question of sport fishing, I don't, you know, some are going to accuse you of doing whatever you do, but that's fine. On the question of sport fish bail schedules, have they changed? I noticed in our little peninsula clarion, sometimes you see the same name a lot of times, and you see the same little $125. And I don't, very different thing to me, very different offense to Alaskans if you're snagging a red versus catching a 70-pound king out of season or in closed waters. Have those bail schedules been adjusted as well, or are they remaining the same, or is that something you're even looking at?
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, thank you for that question. I think there is some validity to that, overall I think the bail schedules have changed over the years. Most recently, probably, I'm guessing 6 to 8 years ago, they changed to make it across the board to make a flat fee and then an additional amount per fish. So those bail schedules are published in statute. We can look at them if you'd like, but they address each individual fish. We also have the ability in some situations to charge them when it's a more serious offense as a misdemeanor offense. And that's a good example of what we're trying to do here. Most of those, what you just talked about, are contained in regulation through the Board of Fish and the Board of Game process. Most of those, we have the ability of charging as a misdemeanor or a violation. So we can when appropriate, we can charge a more serious offense as a misdemeanor if we believe that we need to do that.
Follow-up, Senator Machicki.
And my point is, just like in Section 16, obviously you put a different value on different species depending on whether or not we're having return problems or something, right? So I can just, again, it's not for the person who doesn't know about snagging or might be a little over a bag limit of a more common species, but, of course, retaining a 33-inch rainbow trout in a closed season or a large king salmon in closed waters would be something to me that seems like it would be much more serious than the typical sport fish violation. So just something I was thinking about as we struggle with some returns in some river systems might be something worth considering in the future. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Coghill, did you have a question?
I'm going to pass. I have to think on it a little bit.
Very good. Other questions? Senator Stedman.
If a hunter, you know, is licensed and has his tags, all that stuff, shoots a game animal on private property without permission and then doesn't collect the animal, what would he be facing?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, there's a lot of hypothetical there. I'm not sure I know the specifics of the case other than what you just said, so it's difficult to give you a specific answer. In general, we would investigate the case to determine what actually happened. If that person did not have permission, like you said, to be on private property, that animal, in consultation with the district attorney's office, would likely be seized and the person would be charged.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
Well, I was just thinking, it's not something that we run into down in the southeast very often, but there's a lot of private, more private land up with private property in the state. And I was just curious. And then if the animal wasn't harvested, just left there, there'd be most likely a wanton waste issue. And then potentially another concern about taking a game animal on private property without permission. Is that correct, or is that?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, this is Major Chastain. That is correct. We would look at wanton waste charges, potentially, or fail to salvage, depending on the severity of it, and any additional crimes that we would discover through our investigation.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
No, that's it.
All right. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did the Departments of Public Safety, Fish and Game, and I guess Law, did you look at the issue of self-reporting as a as you were going over this whole pretty comprehensive package that's been discussed in the building in the past and using that as a mitigator if somebody, especially in a case where it's clearly he wouldn't have known had not the person self-reported that they made an inadvertent act.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz. So self-report in general is a major topic that we deal with every year. We have quite a few people that self-report hunting violations throughout the state. We have done, in my view, a phenomenal job of encouraging people to self-report and not waste animals and leave them in the field. We've done that through targeted and direct interface with the hunters to make sure that they understand that they're going to be treated dramatically different when they come in and bring that animal in good condition to Office of the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. They're going to be treated in a much different way than if we discover them in the field or if they waste that animal by leaving it there and not salvaging it.
Follow-up, Senator Stoltz?
And thank you, Madam Chair. Is that done on a discretionary basis? Is there anything codified on a lesser penalty or a codified mitigator if they do bring it in, or is it done totally on discretion?
Through the chair, Senator Saltz. It is the state trooper's discretion to decide when it is considered a self-turn-in. Oftentimes, this is an example is that we have to examine what actually is a self-turn-in, and there's lots of variances of what that could be. Oftentimes, it does not mean the first time that they see the wildlife trooper pull up on a four-wheeler at the camp and they want to turn themselves in. That's not a self-turn-in.
Follow-up, Senator Saltz.
I can't get my composure back. I'm sorry. Okay.
Further questions? All right, seeing none, I want to thank Major Chastain, Director Dale. Thank you. That was an excellent presentation of the bill. Thank you to Ms. Schroeder and Director Skidmore for being online and helping us go through the bill. I'm going to set the bill aside. We will be hearing it in the next few weeks. Again, we'll have public testimony on it. It gives committee members time to kind of think it over, see if there's other questions we might have. But I will certainly make sure you know well in advance when we'll be hearing it again. It may be obvious by now that we won't be hearing Senate Bill 172 today, but we will put it on the calendar for next week. So at this time, we will conclude the meeting for today. Our next hearing will be Wednesday, February 24th. We'll be having our annual mining update. So let the record reflect the time is 4:59, and we are adjourned.